What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Because it's not just about John Cash going to a prison. It's not just about me going to a prison trying to bring good news. Rather, it's finding God and grace in these unlikely places and unlikely people.
How did you know where to find me? What did you think you would see here? I live alone.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson. And believe it or not, we are actually in the month of December already. So we are almost to the end of 2020. I know I'm excited for the end of 2020. 2021 has got to be better, right? I know a lot of you are probably feeling that way as well. It's been a weird, weird year. But anyway, before we finish off the year, I've got a couple episodes that I'm really excited to release, including this one that I actually recorded a while back, and I'm excited to finally release it. It's with Dr. Richard Beck, who we've had on before. For those of you who have listened to us from the beginning, or maybe you're hardcore and you went back to the beginning and listened in chronological order, but we did an episode a while back, probably about 3 years ago, with him. The book was called Reviving Old Scratch, and it was a book about the devil, and always a fun topic. So he always picks interesting topics. So this one is based on his new book, Trains, Jesus, and Murder, The Gospel According to Johnny Cash. And it's this really interesting look at Johnny Cash's life and some of the causes he was involved in that I certainly wasn't aware of, like the plight of the Native American and prison reform and issues that were really important to him at the time that he used a lot of his celebrity to help bring to light and to help make changes. So really, really cool. So very excited to release this one for you guys to hear it. The musical guest this week, if we could afford to get the rights to Johnny Cash, we totally would have used that. But as you can imagine, a little expensive. But we do have a super cool guest this week. The band is called Tall Heights. Please go support their work. Great band, great artists. As always, the Spotify playlist that we maintain will be updated. We update it every time we have a new episode with a song by that featured artist. And as always, if you want to support us in some way, if you can, at this point in time, we do have a Patreon. So if you want to become part of our Patreon family, you can find links to that, as well as links to our social media, our blog, and our entire back catalog of episodes at www.thedeconstructionist.com. So you can find all that good stuff there. Or if you're looking for Christmas present ideas, we have t-shirts, we have pint glasses, we have coffee mugs. All of your favorite liquids taste much, much better with our logo on the front. I don't know. I don't know if that's true. Probably not. But anyway, we do have some stuff there. We do have some new blog posts coming. I just posted one a few weeks ago. That's fairly fresh. But again, you can find all of our relevant links through there. One of the easiest ways, too, that you can support us right now is just by telling a friend about us. So if you know somebody who might benefit from this podcast and the work that we're doing, tell a friend. The other easy way to do it is to give us a 5-star review on iTunes. That just helps us get more exposure, gets us out to more people, and we're just trying to get the good word out. So other than that, as always, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate all of you out there who continue to listen. We'll have one more episode in 2020 that'll be out the week of Christmas. So you'll have something to listen to if you happen to be traveling or if you just need to escape from your in-laws for a second. You can tell them you're studying. So there you go. After that, we'll be hard at work recording new episodes in the month of January. So we'll be off the month of January, but I promise you we will be back with fresh episodes in February to kick off 2021 and a lot of really exciting guests that that we have in store for you then. So other than that, hope you guys enjoy this episode. A really happy holidays to all of you out there. Be safe, and especially with the virus still running rampant right now, you know, take that extra precaution if you have to, and then hopefully by about the time this comes out, hopefully we'll have more news on a viable vaccine. So hang in there, everybody. We love you all. Have a great holiday season, and we'll be back in a couple weeks with our last episode of 2020. But until then, I give you, without further ado, Richard freaking Beck. All right. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome back, I should say. Richard, thank you so much for spending some time in your evening here and being a part of the show.
Glad to be back with you.
So last time we had you on, I love the fact that you always seem to pick really interesting topics. So last time, obviously, we had you on about your previous book, Reviving Old Scratch. This time, as we were just talking about before we started recording, got a copy of the new book in the mail, Trains, Jesus, and Murder, The Gospel According to Johnny Cash, and immediately piqued my interest. Huge music fan, you know, love all the old rockabilly stuff. So what an interesting topic, but what led you to writing about, you know, writing this book about Johnny Cash and how it relates to the gospel?
Yeah, well, I think we talked a little bit about this the last time we visited about my earlier book, Reviving Old Scratch, is that I lead a Bible study on Monday nights at a maximum security prison north of my hometown here in Abilene. And didn't know much about Johnny Cash. I mean, knew a little bit about him, probably like some of your listeners. And I bought at a record store a discount copy of Live at Folsom Prison, which is kind of his iconic 1968 live prison concert at Folsom Prison that kind of like pushed his career into kind of superstardom. And so I just bought it, just thought it would be a fun thing to listen to driving back and forth from the prison every Monday night. And what I found on the album, in the reception that you hear on the album from the inmates as they cheer and welcome him in the concert, was very reflective of what I was experiencing out at my own Bible study out of prison, in the gratitude and in the welcome that I receive in the hands of these incarcerated men. And so I just saw a lot of connection between that album, my experience working in a prison, and I just saw a lot of gospel in that, because it's not just about Johnny Cash going to a prison. It's not just about me going to a prison trying to bring good news. Rather, it's finding God and grace in these unlikely places and unlike these people. And so after, you know, a couple months listening to that album, I bought at San Quentin, and that just started a long, deep dive into the music and life of Johnny Cash.
That's so interesting. I love the book. I love your book because you did a wonderful job of research, and I learned some things that I was not even aware of about the life of Johnny Cash. Like I said, you know, huge rockabilly fan, and I used to dig into you know, the old Sun Records stuff. You know, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, of course Elvis, and all those guys. When you were researching this, it seems like a lot of those guys have a very similar background, meaning they grew up in poor families. You mentioned in the book Johnny Cash grows up in Arkansas. His parents are poor cotton farmers, and so there's a certain lesson he learns, you know, growing up through the hardships of being a farmer during that period of time. And then he witnesses this horrific accident that you talk about in the book that really kind of informs not only who he becomes as a person, but a lot of his songwriting later on. I wondered if you could talk about that a little.
Yeah, and some people have seen the movie I Walk the Line with Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon might know a little bit about this history. But yeah, when he was 13 years old, His older brother, Jack, who was 15 at the time, died in a horrific saw accident. The morning of his death, Johnny was trying to get Jack to go fishing with him. But Jack decided to go to the school and cut some fence posts to make some money for the family at the school shop. And while he was doing that, he gets tugged into the saw and it kind of cuts into his abdomen. And he lingered for a few days and then died very painfully. And it was just traumatizing for the entire family. It traumatized Johnny Cash because Jack was his best friend, but he also kind of harbored a lot of guilt and responsibility because he felt if somehow he had gotten Jack to go fishing with him that morning, he might have lived. But then on top of that, his father kind of blamed him for Jack's death. It's kind of an unreasonable thing, but he kind of blamed Johnny Cash for the death. And so he not only felt his own guilt, he had to carry the blame of his father. And that scarred him, I think, in a lot of different ways. But the other legacy of Jack's death was that Jack was going to be a preacher and he was studying to go into ministry. And so dealing with his grief and trying to honor the memory of his dead brother, he was trying to figure out a way to honor his legacy. And he eventually makes this promise to Jack that he would spread Jack's gospel, spread the gospel message through singing gospel music his whole life. And he kept his promise. When he actually went to Sun Records in Memphis, he came advertising himself as a gospel music singer. That's not what he recorded at Sun Studios, but it's kind of how he initially saw himself and saw himself all the way to the end. If you go all the way to the end of his life with the Rubin years, you know, he ends his career with that great song, When the Man Comes Around. Anyway, he sang gospel music his whole life in memory of his dead brother.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That was such an incredible part of the story about how he very cleverly tried to sneak in gospel songs. I read there at one point he goes in and records a song, and we'll talk about this a little bit later. But he records a song and subtly tries to frame it as a promise to his wife, which it probably kind of was, but it was also kind of a promise to God as well. And was able to kind of sneak a gospel song past Sam Phillips at Sun Records.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So he, late in his life, Johnny Cash said that, I Walk the Line, which was written to kind of calm his wife's anxieties about his marital faithfulness, was actually, had a song with two different meanings. And he was also pledging faithfulness to God in that song as well. And so, yeah, he considered I'll Walk the Line to be his first gospel hit. He snuck it past Sam Phillips, who didn't want to record gospel music. He was wanting Cash to record that rockabilly music that you were talking about. Gospel music wasn't selling, but Cash was so passionate about it, he kind of figured out a way to do it anyway.
And I think you mentioned this in the book, too, is he actually recorded it initially as a slower, more somber song. And then Sam Phillips kind of tricks him at the end and gets him to record one more take, a little more up-tempo. And that's the version that they ended up releasing.
Yeah. So Cash wanted to sing it like a slow ballad. He wanted to kind of make it a very romantic, slow ballad song for his wife, a love song. But Sam was kind of, again, pushing this rockabilly beat. And he, throughout the recording session of Our Walking Line, kept trying to entice Cash to kind of push the tempo. Cash just refused. But at the very end, on the last take, he said, hey, just to, you know, just as a one-off, just let me hear it, you know, play it up tempo. And so Cash did. But he assumed after the recording session that Sam was going to release the slower ballad that they had been working on the entire time. But Sam didn't tell him and released the up-tempo version. And Cash only found out about it when he heard it playing on the radio for the first time. So he angrily confronts Sam Phillips about what happened. But I think the nerves, the anger calmed down quickly when he realized that it was kind of like a huge hit. So I think they reconciled over that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I love when you talk about the song though in the book, because you do this really great job of really kind of taking a look at how it represents kind of the life of Johnny Cash and how this promise to walk the line was really kind of an impossible task and really kind of defines the human condition, really, where we're all trying to walk the line in some sense, but ultimately it's, you know, we have good days and bad days, And you talk about the fact that Johnny, by like 1967, I believe, he's addicted to pills. His life's falling apart. His first marriage falls apart. He's on the brink of suicide. And you have this great quote that I love in the book where you say, "But if the gospel according to Johnny Cash is anything, it's not about our ability to walk the line. The gospel isn't about our faithfulness to God. It's about God's faithfulness to us." Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, Merle Haggard, friend of Cash, actually, you know, in the book, I quote him saying, you know, it was kind of ridiculous for Cash to sing "I Walk the Line," because he says Johnny Cash was out of line his whole life. And so he pledges faithfulness to his first wife, Vivian, but he breaks his promises to her. They eventually divorce in 67, and he pledges faithfulness to God in the song. But like you just recounted, he descends into a season of addiction and unfaithfulness to God. And I think that's kind of where a lot of people identify with Johnny Cash. They see him as kind of a broken man, as a man who kind of struggled, and his music reflects that. And his own spiritual biography reflects that. But as I talk about in the book, in 67, when his marriage fell apart and his addiction was at its worst, he got suicidal, and he drives to Nickajack Cave in Tennessee with a very strange suicide plan. He was just going to wander off into the cave networks till the batteries ran out in his flashlight, and then just lay down there in the dark and get so lost he couldn't find his way back out again. So he lays down in the darkness, and then the audible voice of God comes to him, and it says, God says to Johnny Cash, I am still here. And he realizes in that moment, although he had been unfaithful to Vivian, and he had been unfaithful to his friends and his family and God, God had never left him or abandoned him. And so I talk about how in the book, that's the message of grace, right? We can't keep our promises. And if our relationship with God is dependent upon our ability to keep our promises, then we're going to be in trouble. But it's God's fidelity to us, his faithfulness to us, his covenantal loyalty to us, that is our hope. And that's what we call grace.
Oh, that's great. It's funny that section of the book reminded me of two of the quotes that are actually on the official Johnny Cash website, and both of them are quotes by Johnny Cash himself. One says, "All your life you will be faced with a choice. You can choose love or hate. I choose love." And then the very next quote says, "Sometimes I am two people. Johnny is the nice one. Cash causes all the trouble. They fight." And like, what better two quotes to perfectly show the internal struggle, you know, throughout his entire life, right?
No, and I think that's some of the fascination with him, right? He's the man in black, but he's also this kind of preacher, you know, an evangelist of good news. He's this outlaw, but he's also a saint. He's professing his love for God, but he's also singing murder ballads. He's light and dark, all mixed in together, not just in his own heart, but in his music. And I think that is attractive to a lot of people because that seems more true. And normally what you get, you often will get in the music industry, right, the bad boy image, the gangster image, where it's just all darkness. And then you turn to the Christian music industry and it's all, you know, sunshine and rainbows. And Cash was able to sing both types of music in a very complicated and sometimes surprising mixture. And that's what I experience in my own heart, contradictions and paradoxes, good and bad. And it's what I experience out at the prison on Monday nights, where I'm amongst the incarcerated, and yet there's some beautiful things that I see out there. And so I think that's where Cash's music is a great place to meditate on gospel themes of saint and sinner and sin and grace.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that you just commented on, this idea that he almost had more freedom to be able to be a little more raw and a more authentic and more honest by virtue of the fact that he wasn't pigeonholed to one genre or one style of writing or another. He could kind of flip back and forth between the two. He could write a rockabilly album and then put out a gospel album, versus if he had been considered a Christian artist, you know, if he had tried to put out a rockabilly album, I would I would assume that he would have gotten a little pushback on that.
Yeah, and I think country music is generous that way. I think country music is able and has always expressed kind of the dark side, right? The drunkenness, the rowdiness, the murder, the domestic violence. I mean, the country music can go to some dark places, and yet country music is also very rooted in gospel music as well. And so I do think there's a rich textures and contrast in country music because of that. It's closeness to the raw human predicament, but it always has a foot in the gospel tradition as well. And I think it gives it a lot of interesting interpretive possibilities for an art form.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit more. Talk about his writing tendencies, because he was very different than, and you point this out in the book, very different than his contemporaries. So at the time, Elvis is putting out, you know, these kind of, I think what they refer to as like teeny bopper, like love ballads and stuff like that. Meanwhile, Johnny Cash is writing some very dark stuff, and he tended to gravitate, it seems, towards the darker, grittier material.
Yeah, like in the book I talk about early on, one of his first songs that he played for Sam Phillips, and they eventually released his Folsom Prison Blues. And there's a line in there, a very famous line, where it says, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die." And at the time, they didn't know if you could say something like that on the radio.
Yeah.
And so Cash was able to kind of go to some very dark, even sociopathic places in his music early, which kind of set him apart from those early rock and roll artists like Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley. And I think a lot of it had to do with because of the darkness that in his life. Like, I think he struggled a lot with his own inner demons, and he was able to identify with dark characters and dark material. And because of that, I think it marked him as a very different artist, right? There was a kind of a sinister aspect to his personality and even his stage presence with that kind of all black attire, that he wasn't just trying to entertain the young people. He was doing something kind of different. And he kind of really identified a great deal with the folk tradition. And the folk traditions giving voice to some darker themes as well. Like one of the first songs that caught Rick Rubin's attention when he was working with Cash late in his career was the murder ballad "Delia's Gone," and it's just a very dark song about a domestic homicide. But that was a song that had been kicking around the folk tradition for generations, and so that's where Cash would mine a great deal of his materials, is from folk music and the themes that emerged out of that genre.
What's so interesting to me is I love where in the book you kind of tie his, you know, we've mentioned the term murder ballad, his murder ballads, to this idea that human beings are more than capable of creating enough of their own hell without needing any help or needing a devil to provide that. Or as I've said before, you know, yeah, I've seen the devil and he looks a lot like me. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's, I think anybody who's honest and self-reflective can detect a dark streak or a shadow side in their personality that that is always threatening. And a lot of us can feel that there's just a thin line between the life I currently have and some mistakes I could make that would put my life on a very different path. And I think Cash felt that about himself too, that kind of vulnerability to the dark side of his personality. And if you want to call that the devil or just your inner demons, however you want to think about it, I think a lot of us kind of feel that moral pull in our lives. And we, you know, we spend our lives trying to keep the, you know, the demons at bay in that sense. Now, Cash did. He was a believer in the devil. In fact, there's a famous scene I talk about in the book where on national television, he kind of talks about the devil as a foe and as an enemy and as an adversary in his life, and how he was going to spend his career kind of pushing back against the devil. And I think that was largely due to his struggles with addiction. as I talk about reviving old scratch, when you live and spend time like I have with people in recovery, you know, there's a lot of talk about spiritual warfare, a lot of talk about the darkness. And we can debate the metaphysics of all that, but I think anybody who can understand inner demons and a struggle against the dark side of the personality is going to be people in recovery, people dealing with addiction. And that was definitely Cash's story. He kind of constantly described his addiction as a form of like demon possession.
Oh man, that's interesting. Yeah. It kind of seems like, you know, regardless of where you stand on, you know, whether there's an actual, you know, being an actual devil, it seems like there's plenty of negative ripple effects caused by human choices. Enough of those to go around, you know, as it is, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, like I said, I think anybody who's self-aware, knows that we spend a lot of our lives, trying to be a decent human being. And it's not always easy. We're constantly tempted to become selfish or give in to prejudices. And we're not the people we want to be. You know, we kind of have a shimmer of guilt around our lives, right? There's a person I could be. I could be a better father, a better spouse, a better friend, a better neighbor. And so we recognize the gap between our moral aspirations and the person I am today. And so I think we all kind of feel like we're in a struggle there. And, you know, and in the Christian tradition, that's kind of been described as a battle against the devil. But you can be an atheist and identify with the psychology being described in all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Great segue. You keep teeing me up here. This is great.
you're welcome.
Yeah, because my very next question was actually, I found this part very, very interesting. And again, this is another one of those instances where I wasn't aware of this history of Johnny Cash, and I thought this was absolutely fascinating and something I think people should know. But in the book, you talk about Johnny Cash's struggle with addiction, as we were just talking about, and how his career kind of takes a downswing. And when he really starts to kind of revive his career is when he pitches this crazy idea of this Folsom Prison concert. And he starts his comeback and starts getting his life together. Around this time, I think he marries June Carter. And he records this prison concert that eventually his label reluctantly agrees to let him do, which ends up winning him 2 Grammy Awards. But what was I thought that was the most interesting part of this, though, is that he had been doing free prison concerts for like a decade prior to this. So talk about how, like, because that backstory is really interesting, and talk about how he got started doing that and what his interest was in doing these free shows for prisons.
Yeah, well, I think obviously his early hit, Folsom Prison Blues, which we mentioned has a sociopathic reference to shooting a man in Reno just to watch him die. But if you listen to the song, it's really a song about loss and alienation and loneliness. It's a blues song. And the guy sitting in prison is listening to a train pass by, and he imagines all the happy people on the train, and he's stuck in prison. So there's this contrast between kind of happy people off to happy places with the incarcerated singer. And the regrets and the loss that he's experienced. And so the ache of the song appealed to prison audiences. So they began writing him. And he eventually accepts an invitation to play a live concert in Huntsville, Texas here. Anyway, a thunderstorm broke out during the concert and all the electricity goes out. So there's no amplification. So the prisoners defy orders and move up to the foot of the stage so they can do a Johnny Cash unplugged concert, basically. And just the ache and the desire for those prisoners to be close to him and how happy they were just to have him there, like how much he honored them to come, touched him, profoundly. And so he kind of became addicted to doing these concerts because of the reception he received, unlike any reception he had received from any other audience. And so that was like in the late 50s. And so for like, you know, the next decade, he did over 30 concerts for no compensation in prisons, you know, often in air-conditioned rooms on makeshift stages. And every time he went, it kind of pricked his heart and his conscience, and he eventually became a national voice for prison reform in America. He even testified before the U.S. Senate, asking for more humane treatment of the incarcerated in the United States.
Yeah, the thing I thought was really interesting too is there was this quote, and I can't remember it exactly, but somebody asked him about just the concept of doing prison concerts and what about the victims and that sort of thing, and he has this really great response. And I think he said it was something along the lines of, you know, if we have more humane treatment and we work towards reforming these prisoners, then hopefully there will be fewer victims when they get back out into society.
Yeah. And here's the thing is I worked in prison, and I can tell you for a fact that the men in prison are themselves victims. Like, if you ask them to tell you their story, you know, they were themselves physically or sexually abused, coming from broken homes. You know, the idea that somehow has this beautiful life and then they go out there and commit a crime. I'm sure there are like sociopathic people like that, but that's not the norm. The norm is that victims produce victims, and they produce more victims, and we just pass our pain down generationally. And so this idea of just seeing the incarcerated as evil, again, there are evil people out there, but the men I work with have horrific stories of their upbringing, and they almost didn't have a chance. And so a lot of us that pride ourselves on being good, upstanding citizens, you know, at the end of the day, there, but for the grace of God, go I. If we had been abused or beaten or born into, you know, chronic poverty and familial chaos, like who knows how we would have ended up. Like our virtue is really the product of fortune. You know, we're very lucky. Often, and the trouble is, we often take moral credit for things that we didn't even have any responsibility for.
That's so true. Adam and I have talked about before on the podcast about winning the birth lottery. You know, like,
yeah,
I just so happened to be born a straight white male in 21st century America to two loving parents. You know, in a middle class household. It's like, how did I get so lucky? You know.
Yeah. And then we take credit for that. Like we're good people, but largely our like I said, our virtue is the product of circumstance. Now that's not to say that we don't exercise our choices and that people in bad circumstances don't have free will. I mean, I'm not trying to wade into those waters. I'm just saying it's a lot more complicated. And this is kind of what we're talking about. It's a lot more complicated than separating the good people from the bad people. That line runs through every human heart.
So to keep on the same topic here, the same theme, you dedicate a chapter in the book to this man named Glenn Shirley, who was a prisoner at Folsom, and he writes a song called Greystone Chapel, and you talk about at times the cost of solidarity, and you bring up the theme of solidarity a lot, which I thought was really interesting. So talk about that, and then kind of talk about a little bit about when solidarity doesn't always necessarily have a positive outcome, and yet, you know, the need for solidarity, the need to make the attempt.
Yeah. So Glenn Shirley was an inmate at Folsom Prison, and he had written a song called Greystone Chapel, which got its way to Cash. And so Cash, wanting to, again, express solidarity with the Folsom inmates, sang the song at the conclusion of the Folsom Prison concert. And so it's this iconic moment where Cash, at the very end, sings a song about faith from a song using the words of one of the very own, right, one of Folsom's very own. And he honors them by letting their words end the concert. It's just a great story of solidarity, identification with and standing with the marginalized. Well, after the concert, Cash and Shirley met. Cash took an interest in him and pledged to himself that he would try to help Glenn Shirley get out of prison early, try to get him early parole. And he was successful, pulled a few political strings with his celebrity status and got Glenn Shirley out. And he even gave Shirley a job. He joined the Cash concert tour as a performer. But Shirley was a pretty disturbed guy and eventually made some bizarre, threatening remarks to the band members. And they said, you got to get rid of this guy. He's dangerous. And so Cash reluctantly cuts him loose. And so Shirley bounces around, gets back into drugs, is homeless, and eventually commits suicide. And when I read that, it struck me, because we like to see the iconic moment of Johnny Cash shaking Glenn Shirley's hand from the stage at Folsom. Like, there it is, Johnny Cash shaking the hand of a guy in jail. And that's what the gospel is all about. But if you know the whole story of Glenn Shirley, you know that story doesn't end well. There's a lot of grief and sadness. And it just caused me to reflect in the book and in my own life that I wonder sometimes if that's why we avoid solidarity, why we avoid messy, complicated relationships with people, because we want to protect ourselves from the cost, from the risk, from the vulnerability that a mutual give and take would entail. And so I just took that Glenn Shirley story, just kind of say, you know, we sometimes in Christian audiences, and especially kind of liberal, progressive, social justice sectors of Christianity, this idea of solidarity and standing with the margins is like, you know, we just talk about it all the time. But then you look in the world and realize not a lot of people are actually doing it. Like, we talk a good game and we express solidarity on social media, but when it comes to life and blood relationships, we're often missing in action. And I think we're missing in action because we're afraid of the cost, right? We want to go to the prison, but we don't want to have a messy situation like a Glenn Shirley in our lives, who is scary and complicated and ultimately heartbreaking. But I think the love demands that. What I say in the book is, if you love anybody well, you're going to open yourself up to that risk, and that's the choice. It comes. It's just the price tag you pay. Anybody who's loved a child or a spouse or a friend or a family member or somebody in their neighborhood that have tried to walk a path with a person, especially if they're a difficult person, knows that there is a cost to love, and a lot of us don't want to pay it. And so it's easy to just kind of stay in our homes and on the internet and love the world from a distance. It's a lot safer that way. So anyway, I use the whole story of Johnny Cash and Glenn Shirley to kind of meditate on the cost of love.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, what I think is also interesting too about this story is that it, you know, even though in ultimately, you know, the Glenn Shirley situation or example doesn't have a beautiful ending, you know, that I'm sure Johnny wished it would have, you know, so he can say, look, here's this man who was fully reformed and now he's a good steward of society and that sort of thing. It would have been very easy for him to wash his hands of this man, and yet at the very, very end, after Shirley dies, Johnny Cash pays for his funeral.
Yeah. And that's that kind of is goes back to that theme of faithfulness and fidelity, you know, that whenever we stay faithful to each other and just walk the journey, even if it's hard and even if it doesn't get it to the happy ending, but that imagery of sticking with each other is what God does for us, right? God's loyalty to us, that no matter how messed up we get, God's always going to be there. So, I think Cash's commitment to stick with Glenn Shirley through his whole life was a great example of how we can be sacraments, representations of God's faithfulness.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful story, even though it has a tragic ending. It was kind of like, you know, this beautiful example of how, you know, at our worst, God still stands by us, you know,
yes.
I thought that was just such a cool story. So talk about Johnny Cash's second attempt at a recorded prison concert where he almost starts a riot. You make this really interesting connection to solidarity there, along with lament, which is a really great topic we just addressed on the podcast. So I'd love for you to tell that story and kind of connect that.
Yeah, this might be my favorite Johnny Cash moment. So after At Folsom Prison was recorded and it got so much publicity and success, they quickly did another album called Live at San Quentin. And so again, wanting to kind of express solidarity and give voice to the prison experience, he steps up to the microphone and goes, you know, guys, I don't really know how you feel about San Quentin, but if I was in your shoes, this is how I would feel about San Quentin. And he rips into this song he wrote, and the opening line is, San Quentin, I hate every inch of you. Another line is, San Quentin, may you rot and burn in hell. And it's just line after line of just stinging rebuke and venom poured out on the San Quentin prison. And by proxy, right, the entire prison system, its inhumanity, its brutality, its ineffectiveness. And Cash is so successful in kind of capturing the feelings of the men, how they felt about San Quentin, that after the song ends, they just erupt. And I would encourage your listeners, just go to that song and listen to it played and listen to the response. And it goes on and on. And then they demand that he sing it again. And so he does. He sings it twice. And then the response at the end of the second playing is even longer. And the story goes that the room got kind of dangerous. Like it felt like the response of the prisoners was pushed the room to the edge where it was almost on the edge of a riot. And Cash told his producer afterwards, who said, you know, if I had said, let's go, totally the room would have rioted. So it was right on the edge. And so that's my favorite Johnny Cash moment at the time. He almost started a prison riot in San Quentin. But I use that story to illustrate the reason why the room got so energized like that is because how successful he was in putting himself in their shoes. They had felt seen. And so I talk about how that song, San Quentin, isn't really a gospel song in the sense that it's not a very happy song. It's just it sounds like the prophets, kind of a stinging rebuke. But that's sometimes how grace sounds like. Grace sometimes sounds like an indictment because it is speaking a word for the oppressed over against those who are oppressing. And that means that sometimes gospel songs might have an angry edge to them and also might be expressing a lot of lament and grief and sorrow.
Yeah, it really is a modern lament. You know, it's I listened to it. You know, I listened to the entire album a few times through, and it really is just kind of this cry out, like, God, where are you? Which I could imagine from the perspective of prisoners who are in this prison that at the time wasn't really well known for having great living conditions and, you know, and that sort of thing. So it really is. It comes across like a modern lament.
Yeah. Like, again, I would tell your listeners, if you don't know anything about Johnny Cash, listen to San Quentin played back to back, and listen to the response of the prisoners, and the sound of their response will tell you everything you need to know about the kind of artist Johnny Cash was.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it's a great record. He kind of liked to push it too a little bit. Cause I remember, the first time I listened to the Folsom Prison record, I remember at one point he says, you know, this is being recorded. He starts laughing in the middle of a song and he's like, you know, I can't say hell and I can't say shit. And they were like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He gets a rise out of the prisoners and he's like knowing full well that this is recorded and they're going to have to take it out, you know?
So yeah.
Pretty funny.
And that, but that's the paradox. That's the paradox of the guy, right? He's up there he's up there cursing and then he's going to sing a gospel song at the end of the concert.
Yeah, you know?
He creates these really weird, whiplash effects with his music, which I just find fascinating.
Yeah. It's this odd dichotomy. So the other thing that, that I didn't know about Johnny Cash, and again, this kind of goes back to his desire or his almost talent or ability to stand with the people who are marginalized, stand with the people on the margins. Not only did he stand up for prison reform when probably not a lot of people were, but he also advocated throughout his career for the Native Americans and the treatment of Native Americans throughout the history of the United States. And he began writing songs on this topic back in the 50s, like Old Apache Squaw. And then he writes this concept album in the 60s called Bitter Tears that his record label and radio stations were not real happy with. But it was important to him, and he obviously pushed hard enough to get this album released. And I think I read somewhere that he said that nobody else was speaking up about it. And so, you know, he was going to kind of take that mantle. But I'd love for you to talk about that. And then what I thought was really funny is the story where his reaction to when radio stations refused to play it and his way to try to get them to play it. I thought that was really funny. But talk about that in general and just kind of his stand.
Yeah. So, you know, we know his kind of activism for prisoners, but a lot of people don't know his concern and his activism on behalf of Native American peoples. And he was one of the first artists in the music industry to kind of throw his reputation and his career, his celebrity status behind kind of Native American concerns. So he recorded a concept album called Bitter Tears, which is basically a collection of Native American protest songs. And a lot of the songs are extraordinarily harsh and critical of the American nation and American history and the American government and the way we would break our promises to indigenous peoples over and over again. So when the album was released, again, this isn't rockabilly music that teenagers are going to listen to, right? Who wants to listen to an entire album that just calls out and indicts, you know, the American nation in its treatment of Native Americans? And so a lot of record companies just didn't play it. A lot of radio stations didn't give it any airtime. And he got really frustrated with that. So he takes out a full-page ad in Billboard magazine. And the opening line of the ad is, DJs and radio managers, where are your guts? And so he calls out the entire industry as kind of gutless. And as the story goes, he burned a lot of bridges. A lot of people didn't like being kind of called out like that. And we still don't like being called out. Who likes being called out, right? And so he spent a lot of his social capital to get airplay for that album. But I also think that is a great illustration of what solidarity involves, right? It might involve you taking unpopular stands, and it might involve you kind of getting dinged a little bit. Bitter Tears is a great example of that.
Yeah, and I love where you call this in the book. You call Bitter Tears liberation theology according to Johnny Cash.
Yeah. Liberation theology, I'm sure your listeners know, is the idea that kind of God has a preferential option for the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed. And so basically that's what Bitter Cures does. It kind of sings American history from the vantage point of the Native Americans. And when you look at American history through their eyes, it's a very different history. But that's the same way it works for the gospel, that if you ask the poor and the oppressed and the marginalized, what is good news for you? What does salvation and emancipation look like for you? That's a very different gospel than if you ask the powerful and the rich, what is good news for them? So I talk about in the book that there are a lot of different gospels out in the world, and you have to pay real close attention about whose gospel you're going to listen to. You're going to listen to the gospel as it sounds on the margins of society, like out where I am under prison, or you're going to listen to the gospel as it comes from the rich and the powerful. Who is the gospel going to benefit? That's kind of the question of liberation theology.
So talk a little bit about, there's kind of a third group of people that he uses his celebrity to kind of provide a voice for. And that is, he wrote a lot of war songs. And in particular, he kind of wrote about Vietnam War and soldiers and kind of the horrific conditions that they were experiencing and dealing with. So talk about how he was a voice for those people.
Yeah, so one of the things I want to do in the book is not just kind of praise Johnny Cash as kind of a moral hero, because there's some parts of his music that might trouble some people, especially people kind of on the political left. And some of that is his nationalistic music. He sang a lot about America, but he also sang, like you've mentioned, a lot about war and valorizing a variety of American battles. And one of the things I talk about is that when you look at his war music, that his war music is at its gospel best, and I think also at his artistic best, when he isn't just praising a military victory, but is rather articulating the trauma and the pain and the loss of war. So I think some of his best war songs are intimate songs about the effect of war on the soldier and the traumas and the pains that they, and the scars that they carry in their lives.
Yeah. And so you mentioned this, and I think this is a good place to go. His patriotic songs, he had a lot of those as well, which on the surface seems kind of contradictory compared to all of the material we just talked about. So talk about that and kind of how he also had a lot of these very patriotic songs as well.
Yeah, that there's a tension there. And I wanted to explore that a little bit. And the argument I make is he was very proud of his country. He served in the Air Force. He was a very proud American patriot. But his patriotism and his love of his country would be woefully vulnerable to misappropriation if albums like Bitter Tears and At Folsom Prison didn't exist. That albums that kind of express a critical voice about America. And it's that capacity for criticism where I locate his patriotism. So here was an artist that was able to love America and praise America, but he was also able to say very harsh and critical things about the country he loved. And I think that's a form of patriotism that we have lost in 2020, where today it seems that if you voice criticism of your country, you'd be taken as unpatriotic. So I kind of try to protect his patriotism and his nationalism by drawing attention to the entire body of his work, how he was able to and had the capacity to be critical of his country. And Walter Brueggemann calls that the prophetic imagination, the imagination to imagine that the status quo or your nation could stand under the judgment of God, that God could be unhappy with us. And I think Cash demonstrated that throughout his whole career. And I think that's what keeps his love of country on safer ground than if he lacks that critical edge, which I think a lot of Christians on the right of America today are lacking that critical capacity.
Yeah, it seems almost as if we've lost the ability to say, you know, hey, it's okay to have pride in your nation, but then to also say, but we can be better. We can do better.
Yeah, it seems like you're torn between those two options, right? So it's like, you know, criticism involves kind of hatred of America on one side versus you just baptize everything that America does and wave the flag and praise Jesus. And I think Johnny Cash is an interesting location to think about that the middle ground there, where being grateful for a country that has given you a great deal can also be combined with somebody who could sing about how, like, this country has treated Native Americans and incarcerated horribly and in very dehumanizing ways. That's a part of America's story as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought this was an interesting backstory too. Johnny Cash's nickname, as you mentioned throughout the podcast, is the Man in Black, and it's based on his choice in wardrobe. And this goes all the way back to his very first performance in a church. So talk about that and how you relate this to the idea of solidarity and a view of the cross, because I thought that was really neat.
Yeah. So I think most of your listeners have probably heard Johnny Cash described as the Man in Black. And that goes back to his very first concert. They were going to play at a church, and he, Luther Perkins and Marshall Grant, were going to go to the church and play. And they didn't know what to wear. And the only shirt that they all had the same color of was black. So they wore black to their very first concert. And Cash made a joke that night that, well, black is better for church. And that kind of started a preference of his own to just wear black attire, which again was a different choice. Because if you look at a lot of the early country acts, they were all very fringy. You know what I'm saying? They're wearing those buckskin coats and fringes and sparkly rhinestones and boots, and Cash gets up there wearing, you know, black. So he had a very different look as well. And that was really just a preference. Like, it didn't have any particular meaning. Eventually, though, people kind of associate with, like, an outlaw image. And when I ask people, what do you think of when you think of the Man in Black? They usually think, well, it's an outlaw image.
Yeah.
But in 1971, Cash was on the campus of Vanderbilt University, and this was a time of race riots and concerns about economic inequality, and the Vietnam War was raging. So a lot of social chaos going on, not unlike our world today. And these college students kept pushing Cash, saying, where do you stand on this, Mr. Cash? Where do you see yourself on all of these social issues? Where do you stand? And in response, and as an answer to those college students, he wrote a song called The Man in Black, where he reinterprets his clothing as a sign of solidarity. So he says right out in the song, he says, you know, I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. And he goes on and talks about how he wears the black for the elderly and for the drug addicts and for the soldiers who die in war. And he just goes all the way through the song, identifying with all these different kinds of suffering people. And he says, basically, my black clothing is a sign of grief. It is funeral clothing. It is expressing sorrow for the pain of these people. And so for me, even though it's not my favorite song musically, I think The Man in Black is probably my favorite song of his theologically, because it is just an overt expression of him identifying with the suffering and the pain of people who the American dream had left behind.
That's such a polar opposite of so many of the rock stars throughout history, you know. Yeah, just such an interesting take and such an interesting use of his platform and his fame, too.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's an interesting thing to talk about, because, you know, Christianity and art are hard to blend together, right? It's hard to be prophetic with your art, right? Because you need to be somewhat commercial to sell records, but you also want your art to speak the truth. And I think he, you know, he struggled with that his whole life. I think our artists today struggle with that. How political should they get? But it's definitely interesting to watch him get political with his music at a variety of locations in his career.
Yeah, it's funny too, because you know you see a lot of the artists who do speak up, and the backlash they get is stay out of politics, you know, stick to music. And then on the flip side, the ones that don't are accused of not using their platform for good. You know, it's kind of damned if you do, yeah, damned if you don't.
Yeah, and I think Cash is interesting in that regard, because I know I spoke to a lot of older audiences, boomer audiences, and they just love Johnny Cash, right? He's their guy. And but his willingness to get political on the Man in Black song and Bitter Tears and Live at Folsom Prison, his advocacy before the Senate for prison reform, I think he can become a place where we can put up somebody there that they admire and kind of go, you know what, if Johnny Cash can get political, it's okay to get political, you know? So I think he might be the kind of artist and patriot that we need right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So talk about towards the end of his career, and I'll never forget when this song came out, because I was just kind of blown away just at the song choice in general. But later in his career, he does multiple albums with the famous producer Rick Rubin, who a lot of people know. He's produced everybody from Weezer to the Beastie Boys and Metallica and everybody in between. But he does a cover song, the song called Hurt, which is actually written by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. And the song was obviously about Trent Reznor's own demons that he battled his life. But it really ended up becoming this song that really was about Johnny Cash and kind of a reflection on his life and career. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so Cash's career in the 80s was kind of on the downswing, and he eventually got cut by his label. And so his career was basically over. But Rick Rubin, you know, producer of, you know, metal bands and rap and hip hop, you know, was looking for a challenge. And so he reached out to this aged country icon and wanted to see if they could do some music together. And the two of them produced, at least during Cash's lifetime, four albums, the American recording albums, that a lot of people consider to be the very best music that he recorded in his life. And one of the things that Rubin did, like to point out, a bit of his genius, was he would take these songs from a younger generation, like Rusty Cage or, you know, Hurt, and he would get Cash to sing it. And there is this contrast between these youthful lyrics, but sung with the perspective and the voice of an aged person. And when you kind of add Cash's age to Trent Reznor's lyrics, it became something quite miraculous, because certain textures in the song were able to emerge. And a lot of it is how sad this song is. And it became, you know, perhaps the great song of his life. I mean, right now, I'll look and research this for the book, that Rolling Stone considers her, Cash's cover of her, to be like the second greatest cover in rock and roll history. I mean, it's just timeless what he did with that song. And then there's the video. A lot of people will speak of the video and just say the video is just one of the greatest music videos ever recorded. And it evokes a lot of the same retrospective themes of life, because you see pictures of the dilapidated museum that had fallen into ruin that Cash had run, called the House of Cash. And you just get this sense of Ecclesiastes, right? Life is this pursuit of fame and fortune is just vanity of vanities. But yeah, I think that was Rubin's genius, is the way he would get Cash to sing these younger songs, and Hurt was probably the quintessential example of that.
Yeah, unbelievable. I remember when that song came out, and just I think everybody was just kind of stunned by just how he just kind of adopted it and made it his own. I prefer that one to the original version personally. I mean, it's so good.
Yeah, it's so good.
So one last question for you before we let you go. What was your kind of lasting takeaway from, you obviously did meticulous research and made a lot of really interesting parallels and connections. So what was your kind of lasting takeaway from doing all this research and writing this book?
I think it's this idea that grace comes to us in unlikely people and places, kind of what I said at the very front end. Because the way I tell it is, you know, when Cash gets on the stage at Folsom Prison, we look back and go like, hey, that was the pinnacle of his career, the high point. But if you know his story, that concert was, well, he was at a bit of a crossroads at that point in his life. Musically, he was struggling, and the record company was thinking about letting him go. He had divorced Vivian, so his marriage and family had fallen apart. And he had recently tried to get sober, but that was still shaky. In fact, he popped a couple of pills before he got on the stage at Folsom Prison. So, like, everything about his life is very fragile. But what makes the album so iconic, what made it so successful, wasn't Cash. It was the audience. I mean, that's why it's a live concert, right? It was the sounds of the room and the enthusiasm and the cheering of the prisoners that makes the album unforgettable. And so, as I argue in the book, you know, those inmates saved Johnny Cash's career and probably his life in how they received him. And that is what drew me into his story, because that's what I experienced on Monday nights out of the prison, is that you would think that I'm the person going out there to share the Bible. But more often than not, those are the guys out of the prison that saved me. And so to me, that's the big takeaway, right? Grace is going to come to you in unlikely places if you cross those social boundaries to meet the Jesus who's on the other side of the railroad tracks.
Beautiful. What a great place to end. And before I let you go, though, where can people keep track of what you're up to and follow you? And where can people pick up this new book?
Well, the book is online at Amazon or IndieBound or Barnes & Noble. So any of your online affiliates, should be in local bookstores as well. So they can pretty much get it anywhere. So it's Trains, Jesus, and Murder, The Gospel According to Johnny Cash, which is an album title that comes from my son. I was listening to a lot of Johnny Cash in the car during this year or two of writing this book. And so my son has to listen to it on the drive back to, you know, and forth from school every day. And so one day Aiden looked at me and said, "Hey, Dad, you know what? I've been listening to all this Johnny Cash music, and it seems like Johnny Cash sings about three things: trains, Jesus, and murder." And I said, "That would be a great title for a book." and it became the title for the book. Yeah.
Is he getting any royalties based off of this now, since he did provide it?
Yeah, he probably should. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but I think he takes great pride that he titled his dad's book.
That's fantastic.
I think he's very proud.
Yeah.
Of that. Yeah. And anyway, but also I'm a blogger, and so people can find me writing every week on my blog, Experimental Theology. So that's the other place you can find me. And my speaking schedule's on there too, and so I might be in a town near you. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thoroughly enjoyed this again. Like I said, it's a book that really contains all three of my favorite things. So it's got theology in it, it's got history in it, and it's got music. And so I can't recommend it enough. If you like any of those three things, you'll love this book. So go out and get it. But can't thank you enough. Loved having you on the first time. So happy we could have you back. Thanks again for taking some time out tonight.
Oh, it was lovely. Thanks for letting me talk about the book.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.